With that, I'd like to now introduce our guest speaker for the evening, hailing all the way from Dallas, Texas, Mark H.
Evening, everybody. I'm Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. And power of God separated me from alcohol the morning of October 19th of 1982, and that power has kept me separated from alcohol since that time. My home group is called the Clean Air Group in Dallas, Texas. I didn't name it that. that's just the way that works, you know. It's good to be here with you all. I can't remember when I started coming to New York. I was born and raised in the Midwest, a state called Iowa. Lived on a farm for the first 10 years of my life, went to town once a month, and age 10 moved to a town of 3,000, and that was a huge town, right? So needless to say, before I ever came to New York for the first time, I had a bunch of belief systems in place about you all and where you live and whatever. And it's really funny, because every time I've come to New York, I've just had an absolute fabulous time. I've got a new home now on Staten Island. It's called the Home for the Wayward Husbands. So any of you in here that are soon to be getting divorced, give Tommy a call. You know, and they decided I'd be a great guru since I've been married divorced four times. And let's see, then I had various people offer sponsorship, but one gentleman said he would be my nicotine sponsor. Peter was kind enough to be my hair sponsor. Bill said he thought there was more fruit just living in the first three columns. He'd help me with that. So all my needs are being met back here. But I've been having a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to coming back next August. My mind does weird stuff. When Allie was talking, she's talking about the sponsor and firing somebody, and so my head automatically goes to, you know, those of us who sponsor, we need like a pink slip. You know, and we can write out some stuff. You know what I'm saying? If they don't do what we think they should do, you know, that kind of stuff. And we were talking the other night. We sat down last night with some new drunks. They're not new to AA. One gentleman been around 24 years and got about 3 weeks. And we were talking about how many times he'd read the big book, but like he didn't know what was in the big book. And I thought to myself, you know, you take a new guy, right, or gal, and you give them the big book and say, look, read the first 164 pages, and then we expect something to happen. I mean, that's like giving me a manual, 164 pages, to fly an F-16, and then saying, why don't you go fly the thing? You know, and oh, by the way, be careful and don't hurt yourself or anyone else. You know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is pretty sacred to me, and when I say that, I'm talking about the recovery portion, and I'm talking about the fellowship, and I'm talking about the service piece. And the reason is because it changed and transformed my life. It brought about a revolutionary spiritual experience in my life. And I guess I'm what you'd call a fundamental orthodox member of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you know what that means. My life is incredible today. I was also thinking when Ali was talking about this moment right now, I've never experienced before, I'll never experience again. And if you'd have told me when I came to AA almost 20 years ago that I could get taken to a state of consciousness in which every moment is so new and fresh and exciting, and I could live and move and have my being in that moment, free of my life situation, which changes all the time, I would have said you were absolutely nuts. I would have said there's no truth in that. You know that old statement, now how do you know what you don't know? You know, you see, I didn't know I was powerless over alcohol. I drank alcohol for 20 years. And everything the big book talks about in terms of where alcoholism ultimately takes you, alcohol and alcoholism, it took me. You know, when I sobered up in 82, I had brain damage, kidney damage, liver damage, weighed about 260 pounds, and everything I owned you put in the duffel bag. And there wasn't a single human being in my life who wanted anything to do with me. I didn't need an answering machine. I didn't need a phone because there wasn't nobody calling. And I didn't have any little black book because there wasn't anybody taking any of my calls. Now, when I was a junior in high school, I did not go down to my counselor and say, listen, do you have a program whereby at age 36, this is where I can be? That isn't what happened. I was the second of four boys, and I didn't take a drink till I was 16 years old. My dad died of alcoholism in 1986, and I'd watched that. And I'd made some decisions about, I didn't want to live my life like that. But I took a drink when I was 16, and very early on, the effect produced by alcohol, which I chased for 20 years, I began to experience. And I can assure you, one of the things at some point in time you've got to look at is what is the effect produced by alcohol? And the reason why I say that is because why would I keep going back to something which ultimately began to cause horrific consequences in my life? So I think if that's a really something to take a look about. What was going on in me prior to the drink? Why would I keep going back to the drink? You know, as you continue to progress in alcoholism, it's pretty much a no-brainer of ultimately what's going to happen to you. Those of you that are real alcoholics that drink like I drink know that your economic conditions begin to change. The paychecks get fewer and fewer, and you notice that your home has a different look to it. You know, four bedroom to a car, two-door car, and the car don't have an engine in it. You know, and you begin to notice the quality of food that you're eating begins to go through a change, and somehow in the middle of that, you're trying to convince yourself that this is okay. You know, and if you're like me, I'm a little awake today. I begin to realize the quality of people that I hung out with. There was a dramatic shift in that as well, and that began to happen, and you begin to notice that there's less time with people who used to care about you. And of course, in my own mind, there was always something wrong with them. And I was a geographic drunk. I still carry resentment, I think, against Dr. Bob and some of the old-timers, because they lived in one town their whole life. They made their amends in one day. See? That's not right. That's not fair. That's easy. See? I lived in seven states. That's a lot of moving around. That's a lot of traveling, you know. But that's what alcoholism, does for you. And got out of high school, and I went to college. I love college, you know. But my earliest memories, and even long before I took a drink, and I quit asking myself why, I just look at the experience of that, is all that stuff on page 52. They call it the bedevilments, which I think is a great word, but it seemed to me that that was exactly how I experienced life internally. So much of everything that we ever hear and read and talk about has to do with what I call our external perception of life. And the tragedy of that, though, is we experience life really internally, if you will. Our mind talking to us and our emotional state and that kind of stuff. And, you know, that paragraph so summed me up. I had trouble in personal relationships, you know, like starting most of all at the one with myself. I didn't know when I came to AA that because I didn't have any kind of a personal relationship with myself, my true self, I could not have one with you, which is why I felt so separate all my life, including really my first 10 years in AA. Walk into a meeting like this, you know what I'm talking about. It's like a damn shield comes around you. Everyone's going, hi, how you doing? Oh, yeah, you know, hugging, kissing, you're going in. Is this thing done yet so I can get back to my apartment by myself? You know, but you go, oh, I'm doing just great. Yeah, life's just want to ball, you know, but you just don't look good in the meeting, so you don't do that crap. And, you know, and prey to misery and depression. You know, it's easy. Yeah, I am bound to that. And full of fear. God, I can really tell you what fear did to me. I'm real clear about booze was my solution. Booze has never been my problem. My hair was black when I was drinking. It turned white when I got sober. That's the truth. That's literally the truth. That happened in about 2 years. I'm the kind of guy, when you take booze out of my life, you talk about terrified. You know, you're sitting at home like, you know, well, should I go to a meeting? Oh, God, I'll have to talk to someone. But if I don't go, they said I'd get drunk. And yeah, all right, we'll go. And you're driving down and you say, well, shit, what if someone talks to me? And then, well, what if they don't? And you get there and, hi, how are you? And I'm Mark. And you sit down and you're going, oh shit, what if they call on me? And you get, well, shit, what if they don't? And you know, oh God, there she is. And I got to be, it just, God almighty, it was unbelievable. You know, you go for a job interview and you, your suit is soaked in sweat. You're so fear-based. You know, what have you been doing? I've been drinking. No, I mean work. What do you do? My interviewing skills lacked a little bit of desire when I first got sober, you know. That's a true story. I met a guy in AA about 10 days out of a treatment center and detox, and he worked in this Cameron video store in Denver, Colorado, where I got sober. And so he sent me down to interview with the human resources, and she said, "Well, you know, what have you been doing?" And I said, "It's exactly what I've been drinking." And no, your business background. And it's funny because this is how God works. She told me later, she said, "Mark, all of my training said get as far away from this guy as you can, and I turned to you and said, I'll hire you." And that's how, you know, that's how it works. But, you know, this idea of being useless. You know, it seemed like it didn't matter how successful I was in this external world. There was a part of me that I imagine you guys can relate to this, is like, they're all going to find out. Probably all in the same day. Job's going, she's leaving, IRS is coming down, it's all, and you know, they're going to find out. You know, and I don't know how I got that way. I just can tell you that I got that way. I'm sure there's a lot of therapists have a lot of reasons about, oh, I got that way. I don't know how I got that way. I just know I got that way, and when I drank, I wasn't that way. Which is why I drank for 20 years, which is why every human being that ever cared about me began to talk to me about my drinking early on, and there was no way I was going to go through life without drinking. Absolutely no way. Which is why I drank the way that I drank when I got drafted in college, sent to Vietnam, came back from there, married a gal that I had met in college. We roared off to California. I lived in San Francisco for a year. And from there, Eugene, Oregon, and then Portland, Oregon, and then kind of like Bill says, my drinking assumed more serious proportions. Here's why. You got this Iowa farm kid who was terrified to begin with, and now I'm in this business world getting more and more and more successful. I remember at age 26 checking myself into the emergency room thinking I'm having a heart attack. Well, today I know it's what they call an anxiety attack. And when I drank, these things didn't go on. I was a daily drinker, and divorced that woman, and then I moved up to Seattle, Washington, and from there up to Anchorage, Alaska, and I guess that was the beginning of the end. The beginning of the end for most of us, I think, pretty much is the same, is that everything that had any value in our life slowly begins to drop off. You know, that was really the end of any kind of a career that I had. The relationships were gone, and then through a series of events in 1979, I wound up in Denver, Colorado. At that time, I was unemployed in any area that I'd worked in before, and I have a brother who was an entrepreneur in mood-altering substances. And he asked me if I would care to be employed in that business with him, and since my resume didn't fit anywhere else, I said, sure, I'll do that. So we did that for a while until such point in time as the federal government indicated to him that he really needed not be in that business. And that was, you know, and about a year after that, I'll never forget the morning of October 19, 1982. And I don't have any history of coming in and out of AA. I went to a few meetings about a year and a half before I got sober. Funny story about that. My very first meeting of AA was at a group in Denver, and it was a birthday night. And of course, I'm three sheets to the wind. I don't know what birthday night means. And the guy that was getting a chip was picking up a 32-year chip. Now, chronologically, he was 75. I look at this guy and say, he's 32 years old and looks that bad. He needs to be here. I walked out of that meeting, and AA wasn't for me. See? And I probably went to a few meetings between now and then. The only reason I went to that meeting, I had to be living with a woman who was paying my way. That's how we do toward the end, right? And but that morning, and some of you might relate to this, booze, the magic, the effect produced by booze had probably stopped 5, 6, 7 years before this morning happened. And what would happen is I would take a drink and nothing would happen. And I would drink and drink and drink and drink and drink, and you'd pass out and you'd black out and you'd do all that. But I could not get out of this place I was in. Bill uses some words like the bitter morass of self-pity or the four horsemen I think those are good words to describe. And then the horrible thing was that my best friend Whiskey no longer could take me out of that place. And then you begin to suffer all the physical stuff that comes when you're drinking 24/7. And that particular morning, it's somewhat vague, but I'm sure there was a part of me that morning had all the fun that I could stand. And there must have been a part of me that morning that reached out to this power. And through a series of events, I wound up in a detox, and I wound up staying about 28, 30 days in that place. And then I got released from there. My first 2-3 years were difficult. They diagnosed me with brain damage from some other substances that I like to mix with my alcohol. And of course, some of my pals contend that's never healed. I think they're lying. But and I had to experience life sober, and I was terrified. It was unbelievable. You all held hands, and I thought that was real nice that you did that, and I did not participate in that. I thought that was real hokey. Of course, I look back, I was afraid. I was terrified, you know. And men holding hands, hey, that's a little weird to me. You know, and you all talked about God a lot, and I was just ambivalent about that. I was raised a Methodist, became a Catholic between Vietnam, a bunch of other experiences. Quite frankly, just didn't give a damn anymore. Didn't think too much about anything one way or the other, and I remember hooking up with a guy named Tom, a little short guy, about as opposite as me as you get. And I remember vaguely somebody did some step work with me, not much of it. I remember being afraid and angry all the time. There's a group in Denver, they call it the Fellowship Hall, and it's in Aurora, Colorado, and I used to go there. And you know, if you're fairly new, you can probably relate to this. I was talking to, where's Rita at? Rita, yeah, she's here. And I was talking to her, and how you doing? Yeah, well, I've been better. And, you know, she's hasn't been around a long time. And those first couple of years, you know, I'm paralyzed with fear. My body, which I've damaged beyond belief, is still healing. I don't know what's healing. I mean, one minute I'm crying, the next I'm laughing, the next I'm a sociopath. And you're just trying to live with all that, you know. Some days you can't sleep. Some days you sleep 14 hours. And some days you can't eat. And some days you're just stuffing yourself like a pig. And like you think you're involved with all that, you know. But I go to this fellowship, and there's one of these old-time guys in there who's always happy, joyous, and crazy, you know. Sharing his experience, strength, and hope, and how bubbly his life is, you know. I'd sit and I'd listen to him. And just, you know, and then finally I reached the point, you know, you get sociopathic, I didn't care, and so I'm sharing all my sharings about anger, and I'm angry, and I'm this, and I'm that, and I remember I get in one there one day, and he starts it. Anybody have a topic? Yeah, everybody tell me, you know. And I raise my hand. I want to talk about this. I'm sure it was something that had to do with anger about why life didn't go the way I wanted. He says, I'm tired of you bringing that topic up all the time. You know, if you'd work this damn program. I said, yeah, I'm tired. And I come across the table and I just beating the shit out of this poor old man. You know, I'm like 2 years sober then. That's how much fun I was having in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, keep coming back. It'll get better. That's a lie, by the way. If you're being told that, see, it's just, you want to stay, but it ain't going to get better for a while. It's going to be a little rough out there, and that's the way it should be. You know, it's like, you get to work with someone who's a real alcoholic, and, you know, you say dumb stuff to them, like, well, I feel like I'm suffering from low self-esteem. That's because you're supposed to be. You know, you come into AA with high self-esteem, you're a sociopath. We can't help you, you know. Hell, you live your life doing that kind of crap. You ain't supposed to feel good about yourself. You know, you abandon your kids and the IRS and, you know, oh, I'm supposed to feel good. You know, it's like you go to these crazy treatment centers and they want to give you these affirmations, right? I mean, I basically, about the last 5 years of my life was fairly violent, blah, blah, blah. And they give you this, I'm a precious little child of God. It don't fit the same box, you know. Funny, one guy told me the truth. He said, I'll tell you, when you get high self-esteem, when you get done with all your amends, you know. Oh, one of those guys, you know, the guy that steps and that shit, you know. So I did go to a lot of meetings. You know, I know you have a phrase back here, meetings make or make it. My experience is that's not the truth, but it might be for some people. And there's certainly value in that. I think that the power of God in the individuals within the group can carry you along for a while. But, of course, unbeknownst to me is the meetings won't treat what's wrong with me. And alcohol is but a symptom. You see, alcohol wasn't my problem, and the meetings won't treat what is really wrong with me. And I'm the kind of guy, some of you might relate to this, but you separate me from alcohol, which has been my only solution for ease and comfort in my life, and you put me in these rooms, I get worse. I do not get better. I get worse, except now I got to live life sober, but I got no tools for it, you know? And by the way, you women who think alcoholic men are emotionally unavailable, you have not been an alcoholic man. We are very emotionally available. That's why we drink. You can see it in our behavior after we're sober for a while. We do some pretty bizarre stuff, right? It's because we're emotionally available to ourselves. We don't know what to do with this stuff. It's just oozing out of our pores, you know? So around 3 years, I met a man some of you know in Don P., and he began to take me through the journey. And I did the best that I could with that in hindsight, and I'll fast forward a little. I had 3 great years in that first 10. But in hindsight, I didn't do anywhere near the amount of work out of the book and with the steps that I needed to have been doing. I tell you something, I missed a piece. You know, there's a chapter in it talks about the 4 kind of drinkers. And I think it's in To the Wives. And I was talking with my pal Joe. By the way, Joe sends his love to all of you. He's looking forward to coming back here in August. And we were talking about this the other day about, it talks about 4 kinds of alcoholics really in that chapter. And what we got to talking about is you probably want to find out which one of those 4 you are. And depending on how you drank, that better be how you go after spiritual living. See, I was the 4th guy. I was the guy that was chronic. I was the guy that in and out of institutions. I was the guy that was going to quit for nobody or nothing. I was the guy that no human power can help. And in hindsight, what I did in my first 10 years in AA is I kind of came into AA and I was like a little wallflower. Well, guess what? That isn't going to work. If you're a mad dog for whiskey, you better be a mad dog for God. That's my experience, see? Reason I tell you that is my middle-of-the-road wallflower 10 years, when I look at my first 10 years, put me in the insane asylum in Houston, Texas in 1991. 9 years sober. Came within 24 hours of committing suicide. I was having so much fun not drinking. See? Therapist tried to tell me it was some other stuff. I've been free of that period of time long enough to tell you most of that was about untreated alcoholism. Most of that was about sober. I was in a rage about life didn't go the way I wanted. Because I'd never done what the 3rd step that we read tonight asked me to do, which is this. I offer myself to thee to build with me and you do with me as you want. Which means my life is no longer my business. I didn't do that my first 10 years in AA in hindsight. Now, I didn't consciously wake up one day in AA and say, I think this is the path I'll go, so that 10 years I go nuts, almost commit suicide, right? Now what happened? Take a guy like me all my life, self-reliance, you know, pick yourself up by the bootstraps, tough macho male, blah, 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 blah. That stuff will keep you into self-will, thinking that you've turned your will and life over to God. And hindsight, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I got in more pain. I got to tell you how much I love booze. And this is the truth. Not once in all the years I drank did I ever, one time, ever think of committing suicide. Boy, I did a whole bunch sober in those first 10 years. See, I had to look at that and say, well, what's that about? That's because booze treats what's wrong with me. That's why our big book is so simplistic in this regard. It says, Mark, if you're a real alcoholic, if you've looked at your first step, if this is you, we're going to give you 2 doors, just 2, not 5, 2. Bitter end, spiritual living. What do you want? Well, could you tell me a little bit, what does bitter end look like? Can we talk a little about the bitter end? You know, like, you know, and a gentleman outside we were talking, I think he said something, and I think it's so true, that this has to do with spiritual living. See, I'm looking at both doors, right? And he says, well, what do I have to give up to go to the door of spiritual living? Right? See, I understood that sentence. I understood exactly what it's saying. It's like spiritual living. All my old ideas immediately zoom in. 10 commandments, no sex, no masturbate, nothing. It's all over. It's done. My life is over. And you tell me to embrace spiritual living? Don't think so. Right? You know, can't ever lie again. What? Yeah, no, gotta be honest, forthworth, show up to work every day. You know, be a good... What? Yeah, that's spiritual living. let's talk about the bitter end just a little bit more. You know, like, can we just, you know, and when I look back again, the reason I tell you this, if you want to know what you believe in sometimes, look at your actions. When I look at my first 10 years, my actions tell me I was still heavily involved in self-will. I took a job, I wound up working 68 hours a week. Few meetings, little step work, worried about the money, you know, I'll never forget this. Part of spiritual living is waking up, right? I like to say this. I went through most of my life, I was sound asleep, dreaming I was awake. I thought because my eyes were open, I was awake, wasn't awake. But I come into AA, I described the condition I was in around 5-6 years. I'd bought a home, little wifey poo, a couple stepkids, you know, 1.5 dogs. I say that because one was a real dog and one was a poodle. And I call that 1.5 dogs, and it's a nice 4-bedroom home, and we bought some mountain property and 2 cars in the garage, and being an alcoholic, of course, the mountain property didn't have a home, so I bought $5,000 worth of camping. Hell, all of you could have slept in the tent probably and only used it one time. Can you imagine that? But and all this new furniture, and I'm sitting in this house one night, and for whatever reason, everyone's gone, and I realize I feel like I got an albatross around my neck, and I'm in more fear than I'd ever been. I felt like drinking. I said, something's wrong. I wonder if I've been lied to, because I'm living, quote, the very great American dream, right? I'm sober, I got all this stuff, and I'm so miserable, it was absolutely unbelievable. And it's all through a series of events. I wind up in the nut house in Houston, Texas, and after that event, I wound up going to work for the nut house. So I left Denver, and you know, I was telling Tommy on the way over here that was a very significant event, because your attachments will kill you. When I was placed in this position, I left Denver, Colorado. Everything that I thought defined who I am externally was totally removed from me, including my pals in AA, the home group, everything. And I went to Texas in 1991 with a 78 Saab and $100 in a big book. And I had no identity. And there were no pals, and there was no support group, and there was no nothing. I was telling Tommy, in hindsight, that was one of the most significant events in my life, because when you get placed in that position, you're going to turn to God. Now, I'm going to tell you something else. This is from hindsight. When I look at my first 10 years in AA, I had made my mind God and didn't even know it. I thought that because my mind told me I believed in God, that I knew God. Not true. And the reason I can tell you that is I have a very clear memory of how I experienced those first 10 years in AA. Those first 10 years in AA, I walk into a group like this, I would have been terrified inside. Oh, you wouldn't have seen that. But I can tell you from 1991 to this moment, that has never been my experience since then. I can walk into a room full of people, not know a single one, and I am completely at peace and home. So what happened to me at that time? Well, I really begin to take a look at the big book, and I begin to see all the things that I had been unwilling to do on a daily basis. Now again, there's 4 kinds of drinkers, right? And if you're going to drink the way that I drink, which was every day, ripping and roaring through life, probably doing meditation 2 times a day won't work for you, right? A little step work probably won't work for you either. But I started really looking at the big book, particularly the 10th and 11th step, and I realized there had been a lot of things that I was paying lip service to but wasn't doing. So here was the position I'm in. I'd given life my best shot drinking. I've got 10 years. But you know what I've never really done? I've never totally given myself to this way of life in all the 10 years I've been in the program. So at that point in time, I said, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to completely surrender to this way of life. When I look back, I really did my third step at 10 years sober. And the reason I can tell you that, because from 1991 to this moment, my life is not my business. And I quit making it my business. I don't care where I live. I don't care who's in my life. I don't care what I do. Because every time I care about any of that stuff, I either drink or wind up in nut houses or I'm miserable, packed with anxiety and fear. That hasn't been my experience since 1991. Because if you look again, go back to that prayer, I offer myself to thee, you build me, you do with me as you want. Think about the implications of that. If you're able to live that, can you totally embrace that? Can you be at peace with that? So I get moved to a small town in Texas called Kerrville. This is another important part of my story, a town of 18,000. This is just the truth. There wasn't anybody in that town that had anything that I wanted. Now I got to tell you something about me. I'm not the kind of guy that's going to ask you to work with me because you sound good to me. You're going to have something that I want. And I'm going to come to you and I'm going to ask this question. First of all, I don't believe in any of these dependencies that I see developing. A good message I got from Don was, I'm going to get you as independent of me as quick as possible. As quick as possible. You're not going to depend on me. This is about God. This is about what's in the big book. Don't let anyone read your big book for you. So there's no one in that town that has a damn thing I want. So what do you do? Well, a lot of different books. I started looking at the 11 steps. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. So a lot of different books and a lot of different disciplines started to come into my life. I reworked the first 9 steps, starting on the title page, 4 times in the first 10 years, from 91 to 93. I had a lot of unwritten inventory. I had experienced at a deep level something I did not understand, which is reconstruction of the ego, whereby you come into AA, you have this experience, but you stop, I could say it this way, some people will talk about there's a theory, well, I'll work the steps one time, live in 10, 11, and 12, and if you can do that, God bless you. I can't do that. That didn't work for me, because my ego rebuilds. It's got a new face to it, but it rebuilds, and I start to get resentful, and I start to get afraid, and I start to get miserable is what I start to do. Page 52, the bedevilments begins to show up in my life again. I don't set out to do that. That's a phenomenon that just happens and you and I can't do anything about that. Which is why I continually work and rework the steps. I just finished writing another 4 step, and when I go back Sunday, I'm going to read inventory 4 times. I had 11 resentments, 3 fears, and about 3 pieces of sexual inventory I wrote. I'll take that inventory and read to 4 different people. I still am very actively involved in reworking the first 9 steps. I do that because I like the effect produced by it. Do you follow me? My deal is real simple. Is there's an acid test, I think, and it's called, is what you're doing working? It's a great question to ask yourself. When I say working, the big book is full of promises you and I get if what you're doing is working. Things like this. Power, peace, could be alone at perfect peace and ease. My fears fall from me. I outgrow fear. Serenity. Thy will be done. Pause when agitated or doubtful. Cease fighting anything or anyone. You know, be able to meditate. Sit in the silence. Stop judging people. The list is fairly endless. So for me, it's real simple. If in fact I can't live that, then maybe what I'm doing is not working. You see? I'm very much aware that I'm responsible for life and how I experience life, and it's nobody's fault. It has nothing to do with where I live, who's in my life, you name it. And I am glad I am very, very aware of that. I'm glad I'm willing to assume complete responsibility for that. That's why I continually work and rework those first 9 steps. I continually touch again my first step experience, this relationship I have with alcohol. See? To this day, at almost 20 years sober, I love whiskey more than most people drinking it. I really do. And the reason I tell you that, wasn't that long ago, I just took a look at the first step again. And I swear, my mouth, the saliva, you know, I don't know how you all go back and look at the first step, but I use a thing called the set-aside prayer. Because if you got any time in this program, if you got any experience with the steps, here's your news, your knowledge of your past experience. And your attachment to it. You know, your moment of enlightenment that each of us have, which are completely free experience in your beingness. We all have it if you work the steps. You want to attach to that memory. I hear that all the time. Well, I remember back then I had this great experience. And I said, yeah, that was then and this is now. And so like it has no validity anymore, right? So I use that prayer and I look at those first 33 pages of the book. And I work with this. I rework the steps with power because I got power in my life. I'm not the power, but the power comes through me, right? Now I ask myself, where am I with loss of control today if I took a drink? Path of consideration. 33 pages to answer that question. I got thirsty in there. It was amazing to me. I got thirsty. I literally at times could taste alcohol. That's important for me. Because there's a piece of you that the further away you get from a drink, your mind starts to do some things. You know? Like whiskey's no longer ever going to be a problem. Right? So I started to look at that and I began to realize that if in fact I ever picked up a drink again, I don't have a clue what would happen to me. My last drink lasted a year and a half. I hear people talk about, well, if I picked up a drink, I'd do this. And I think to myself, how do you know that? I picked up a drink one time in Alaska and wound up in St. Louis. I don't know what I'm going to do when I drink. See? I don't know if I could ever make it back again. I won't limit the power of God, but I work with chronic relapsers. People with 10 years or more time, as far as I can tell, at best, only 5% ever make it back to these rooms because of the progressive nature of the disease of alcoholism. I live in a city of almost close to 4 million people. They have what they call an inner group there. And when I celebrated 19 years, I went down there and they keep a record of all the chips they sell. They sold 67 19-year chips in a city of 4 million. You think this ain't a deadly disease? See? I don't ever want to lose my first step experience. I don't want to ever lose that, you know, to understand how deadly this thing is that I'm up against. Yet I got a part of me all the time that wants to, well, it wasn't so bad then, or we've been sober a while. This is why I continue to pursue the course of action that I take today. Why spiritual living has to be first and foremost in my life. I don't ever want to pick up a drink again. Yet on my power, I can't keep myself from picking up a drink. I'm sitting here talking to these two guys last night. One of them had 3 years, one had 7, 8 months. I asked this question. Do you believe that you were involved with your last relapse? They both go, oh yeah. I said, really? Where do you get the idea that you're involved with your relapses? If you were involved with your relapses, that means you choose whether you drink or not drink. The reason I'm an alcoholic is sober. I'm not involved with when I go back to drinking or not. If I had the power to decide when I was going back to drinking, you would have another speaker. Now, I wouldn't be hanging out in the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are other neat places out there. What makes me an alcoholic is the most insane thing I ever do. I do sober at certain times, and I don't know what that looks like and when that's going to happen. And I'm not involved with that. And further on, the book gets clear with me about the only thing that's going to prevent that. Are you in fit spiritual condition today? See, I finally understood something. If you've done some work with the first 9 steps of the book, and you start working with 10 and 11, and you decide you're going to take a few days off and not do the spiritual disciplines, you're just shooting craps. Because the book says the only reason that you and I stay sober, if you believe the book, is because I'm in fit spiritual condition. So what if there a day comes and I say, you know what, I'm kind of busy today. I'm going to ignore all the spiritual disciplines of 10 and 11. Because after all, I got crap to do, you know. Well, that could be the day I'm not in fit spiritual condition. That could be the day this mind says, let's go take a drink. And without something between me and taking action on that, I'm going to take a drink. See, that's what I looked at again in my first step, pages 23 to 43. The idea that the most insane thing I ever do, I do sober, and I can't do anything about that. And here's the horrible part. At certain times. You know, you hear this, and by the way, I'm going to say this again. Don't ever let anyone read your big book. How many of you have heard people say, think through the drink? We all heard that, right, in meetings. Well, if you don't know this, that is not what the big book says. The big book says it's something exactly the opposite. The big book says, here's one of your problems, Mark. There's going to come a time where you won't think at all. Here's the problem with thinking you got power to think through the drink. We all have this happen. I don't know if this isn't true here, but in Texas they sell liquor in grocery stores. So I go in shopping sometimes and I fall asleep and it's always one huge aisle. This is wine and whiskey and then all the beer. And you fall asleep sometimes and you wake up and you're trapped right in the middle of it. And surrounded by a sea of booze, you know? Of course, course, you know, I got sober in 82. There's all kinds of stuff out that I never got to try. So when I get trapped in that situation, I like to kind of look at that stuff. You know, and Zima and Corona wasn't around when I was drinking. You know, and what is it, cold ice? And just, wow, look at all that shit. You know, and that's exciting. And, you know, wine by the gallons. And, you know, and I look at it and my mind goes, yeah, but God, you know, if you do that, you just, you know, and you, so you think through the drink that time, right? I came in here for ice cream. I'm just going to go get the ice cream and go home. And the danger in thinking I was involved in not taking and buying 17 gallons of something that day is that the reason I probably left that aisle safely was I'd been restored to sanity, but I didn't restore myself to sanity. And if I walk in, I get in that situation, I'm not in fit spiritual condition, trust me, I don't have enough of a credit card with a limit for the card I would pull up there. See, I'm not delusional. I'm not this kind of guy that's going to go, well, go give me a couple of brewskis. I'm going to fill carts of that crap up, right? But I once again see the truth of that. I begin to see that in the last year, many times I've been in situations, life situations, in which a guy like me would go drink behind the life situation, and I'm sober looking at those pages, and I once again get very clear on why I'm sober. The grace and power and love of God in my life. Right? And I see that. I begin to see this thing and this horrendous illness I have, that sober I'll do the most insane thing at certain times, and I can't do anything about that. And, you know, and do I need power? See? Once more, Mark at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Mark's defense has got to come from this power. I look at what the book calls the spiritual malady. There's a line in the book that says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, Mark straightens out mentally. See, I begin to realize this one day. You see, the problem is not a craving of the body. The problem is not an obsession of the mind. What sets the obsession of the mind into motion is what I had to start to look at. Which I believe, when I look at my experience, has a lot to do with that spiritual malady, that internal condition about how we experience life, right? I'm full of fear, I feel uneasy, restless, irritable, I'm discontent. Who wouldn't drink if that's how you're going through every minute of every day? You follow? Who wouldn't drink? Who wouldn't be rageful? Who wouldn't be angry? Who wouldn't, you know? And then I look at my second step again. You know, you get, over the years, you really get changed with this. Today, if you said to me, do I have a concept of God? My answer would be no. I have no concept of God. I would just say that my experiences have been such that I've been stripped of any concept. Difficult to put any words to. So I come back to the second step again, and I'm posed with the question, am I willing to believe there's a power greater than myself? And I like to add something to that. Is it possible that I can have a deeper experience with this power? I don't operate anymore with this idea of closeness. You know, you hear sometimes, well, I've got to get closer to God. That is impossible. Because where isn't godliness? See? Book talks about you and I have to get in touch with a deep inner resource, but that we're blocked from the inner resource. I have experience with the inner resource. Steps 4 through 9, ladies and gentlemen, are the things that are preventing me from experiencing the inner resource to bring about this revolutionary spiritual experience that I so deeply need. It lies within as well as without. But the God that I had to experience would lie within me. So my question is, I've never had this moment before in my entire life. Is there more about this godliness, inner resource that I would like to experience? Yeah. Book talks about something I've always loved. It says, faced with a self-imposed crisis. You all understand what self-imposed means? Yeah. We drank the alcohol. Self-imposed. It wasn't done by mother and father and him and her, it and self-imposed crisis. Here's what it is. Lack of power. How you doing? Is what you're doing working? Could use a little tweaking over here, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and you start to look at that. Self-imposed crisis, okay. You can make it. Book says you got to make a choice once again. God's going to be everything or nothing. See? I didn't know this, and I don't know if I'd stayed around A if you'd told me. The steps We'll take every belief system you've ever had, including the new ones you picked up last year through the steps, and smash them to smithereens. And you're going to be uncomfortable. I had this idea for a while. Well, if I work the first 9 steps, then I deserve neat stuff to happen, right? I got rid of that idea. I did that about 2.5 years ago. Here's the neat stuff that happened. I lost my job. I had some physical health problems. My mother passed away. I was unemployed for 5 months, which caused an impact on my economic situation, which caused me to experience myself feeling myself a little different. And that's what you get when you rework the steps. Isn't that cute? Yeah, 18 years sober. Neat stuff's going to happen in your life, boy. Get excited. So that's another idea that has to go. See, I don't work these steps because I think I deserve something. You know, I'm going to have an experience. I don't assign what that looks like. I don't know what that looks like. I just know I live in a world that's whirling and moving all the time, a world of impermanence, and I better be growing or I'm probably going to be going. That's all I know. That's the way it works for me. And so I look at that second step, and it just says, are you willing to seek? You're willing to seek. If you're willing to seek, you'll experience that inner resource. That's a promise. If you're new, if you're willing to take the action to seek, you'll experience that inner resource. Then you look at this third step again, that little requirement. You know, am I convinced my life run of my will does not work? And I did something interesting this time. I wrote out how I was still trying to arrange the show. If you've been sober for a while and go through the steps, you might consider doing this. You know, the book says, if Mark's arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as Mark wished, the show would be great. So I wrote out how I thought that should look. Do you know I had several employees that just weren't doing what I wanted? And I got some pals of mine in AA that weren't doing some things I thought they should have been doing. And there was stuff going on in my home group that wasn't going the way I thought it should be going. And there were several things going on in terms of my arrangements. See? And I said, isn't this cute? See, because I gotta meet a requirement before I do my third step. Am I convinced that my life run of my will cannot and will not work? So I like to look at every area of my life and ask myself this question I told you. How's it working, big guy? How's it going? Do you think there's a possibility there are dimensions available to you and you know nothing about? It's your workplace, financial, physical health, everything. Is that possible, you think? Yeah, because otherwise God would be limited, wouldn't he? So I was willing to meet that requirement over 19 years in this program. Once again, that my life run on my will at 19 years sober cannot and will not work, period. And then I get introduced to what's wrong with us all, and sorry to tell you, it's not whiskey. Selfishness and self-centered. Mark, that happens to be the root of all your troubles. And all my troubles are my own making. And I like to sit with that one for a little bit. There's tremendous power in having an experience with all your troubles of your own making. You know, every one of you in this room probably, if you went home tonight, could make a list of troubles that you may be experiencing. There is tremendous power in realizing you created it all. That's the only way you're ever going to get free. Because if there's any, quote, problem that any of you are experiencing that has something to do with something outside of you, you're not in good shape, because that means something outside of you has got to change in order for you to be free of the problem. Which I think is probably why the big book says, all of my troubles are of my own making. But we don't want to assume that responsibility, do we? I mean, isn't that kind of heady stuff? Come on, surely it's somebody's fault. No, it's really not. It's not your sponsors and mom and dad and your gender and race and color. And no, I'm sorry, it's none of that. It's really not. All your troubles are of your own making, you know. Okay. And then the book finally tells me what's wrong with me. I think it's about alcohol and the craving of the body and the obsession of the mind and the spirituality. And I got this thing with God, and it says above everything, you better get rid of your selfishness or you're going to die. That's what's wrong with you. That's why we are in this room. That's why we drink. That's why we're miserable. our selfishness. They use another three words. We like to please God. Another form of that selfishness, right? And then it says, you've got another little dilemma here with this selfishness, Mark. The very thing that leads to all your troubles and will ultimately take you back to alcohol and has you in adversarial positions with yourself and everyone else, you can't do anything about. Whoa. Well, I don't know if I like that. Well, look at your experience. Have you ever been able to self-will your way out of any of this stuff? Nope. Well, then you got to have God's help. Wow. Okay. See, I see the connection. I see the connection that started in the title page to where I'm at that point. Then I made my decision again, you know. God's going to direct. I'm the actor. God's the father. I'm the child. He's the employer, employee. Then I read the third step prayer. It affirms my decision. That's all that prayer is. It affirmed my decision that once again, my life is not my business. How long I live, my physical health, where I live, where I work, who's in my life, who's not, none of that is my business once again. 19 plus years sober. The reason I don't want it to make it my business, because when I make it my business, I go to nut houses and drink. You all want to make your life your business? Go for it. It's not where I want anything to do with it, ever again. Didn't work for me. Never does work for me. Then I wrote the three inventories. I had 11 resentments. I write a four-column resentment inventory. I love writing the second and third column. Wrote some great stuff on some employees who just weren't doing what I wanted. You know, it occurred to me later, I had this script in my mind of how they're supposed to be, but I never gave it to them. You know what I mean? They're just doing what they're doing, and, you know. So I like to write my first three columns, and then I go back, and then my freedom lies in the connection between my third and my fourth column. Third column, I better see how I'm playing God every time. Then it talks about, Mark, you, there's a little bridge you get across into this fourth column. The bridge is this, that perhaps these people you're mad at in column one are spiritually sick, meaning what they did in the second column that made you angry. And is it just possible, Mark, that you're expecting spiritually sick people to act healthy? It's like asking an orange to be an apple. Don't think it's going to happen. And I get mad at the orange because it won't become an apple. Wish I could give you a more complex explanation, but, you know, it's like you're in a relationship, right? You got some name in column one and he or she's in column two and a whole bunch of stuff. It's the same thing. They're an orange, you want them to be an apple. And you're very angry because they're not an apple and you're trying to manipulate them to be an apple. Either accept the fact they're an orange or go buy a damn apple. But that isn't how we do it, right? We want to do hydroponics and turn the orange into an apple. You need to go to therapy, and by God, they'll turn you into an apple. You know? Trying to arrange my show here. If you just change these 99 areas, I'll be okay. If you just love me like the way I'm supposed to be loved. All that neat stuff, right? You know. So you see that when you write that kind of inventory. And this time I wrote a five-column fear inventory. Column one, what I was afraid of. Column two, when I have the fear, and I like to embellish it a little. Third column, how self-reliance failed me around this fear. And of course, that led me to my fourth, is what role have I assigned myself behind this fear? I wrote some stuff on finances. Here was the role I assigned myself. I have assigned myself the role of a financial planner since I've been sober. You know the problem with that? I have no training as a financial planner, which is probably why my finances don't look the way I'd like them to look. You know that I've never seen that before, right? Isn't that interesting? I'm a financial planner. No, you're not, right? Last piece I did behind fear inventory, what would God have me be? He would have me probably use common sense and go to a financial planner. Right? That's too simple. You know, can't we? You know how we are, right? And I had some sex inventory that I wrote. Get done with that. When I go back, I'm going to do, like I said, I'm going to do four fifth steps. I'll get done with those fifth steps. I'm doing work with several people right now. We're going to swap fifth steps. 19 years sober. I got nothing to hide from anybody. One of these guys is sober, been in and out of AA for 14 years. He's got about 3 months now. I'm going to swap fifth steps with him, right? Got another man that I do some work with. He's 29 years sober. I'm going to swap a fifth step with him. Got a woman who's been sober 37 years. I'm going to swap a fifth step with her. So I'm probably going to read four times. I do multiple fifth steps because I had an experience with it in 1994 or 5 that changed my life. So again, I do things for the effect produced. The big book says do a fifth step with person or persons. You know, I want to make a comment on something too that I've come to understand is, I'm sitting there having this dialogue with this guy one day. I don't even remember what it was about, but he asked me a great question. He said, "Do you have any experience with that?" What? "Yeah, do you have any experience with that?" And I go, "Well, no." He said, "Then I'm not interested in your opinion." Oh, that was interesting. And once I got through writing some inventory on him, I thought, you know what, there's a lot of wisdom in what that man said, and you know, because that's one of our big defects. I want to give you my opinion and experiences I've never had. So what I'll tell you is, if you've never taken a piece of inventory and read to 2, 3, 4 different people, I'm not interested in your opinion about that. But I would encourage you to consider doing it. I did it and had incredible things happen behind that. Sixth step, all I'm going to do is look at the defects of South Will Run Riot at 19 years sober, because they're still there. I haven't become enlightened. I tell people working a spiritual program is nice, but getting even is better sometimes. Seventh step, take all of me, God, you know, good and bad. Take all of me, so I can be of service to you. There's a line prior to your third step decision that says, "With God's help, I can be entirely rid of self." I was giving a talk not long ago, and I made a statement in that room, and here was the statement. Is I'm completely free of anyone's opinion of me anymore. Completely free. This lady said to me, she's been sober, I don't know, 20. She said, "How in God's name did you do that?" And I said, "Well, the part of me that would be concerned about what you think doesn't exist anymore." I said, "Yeah, write a bunch of inventory. Do some fifth steps. Watch what happens in there. Watch how free you can get." So, eighth step. Probably going to have a few amends out of this inventory. And I'll go make those amends. I'll sit across from people. I know I got 4 employees I'll sit across from. You know, I'm CEO of the company. I don't care. I'm a real alcoholic, don't ever want to drink. You know, sit them down and I'll get straight with that stuff. I spend a lot of time working with the strict spiritual disciplines of the 10th and 11th step. There's 4 pages in there. I could spend the rest of my life working with those disciplines. Meditation. I've had a daily meditation life since 1991. If you ask me today what is one significant thing you've ever done in all the years you've been sober that you think impacted you the most, I would tell you meditation. In meditation, I begin to understand the phrase, "Be still and know I'm God." In meditation, I begin to get stripped of my making my mind God. Matter of fact, in meditation, it was I begin to experience that I'm not my mind. I will never forget the first time in meditation when I realized I was not my mind. I can't tell you how freeing that is to understand that you're not your mind. You know why that's freeing? Because if you're identified with your mind and it's yapping to you, you think it has some reality. My mind today is just like a computer. It's got some real faulty software at times. It just prints out this neat stuff, right? I just let it ramble. You know? See, these steps have changed your software. All those incredible practices of 10 and 11. The 10th step is, I work with the 10th step during the course of the day. That's not about analyzing. That's about staying present to the moment. Having conscious contact. Avoiding the danger of anger and excitement and all that stuff. You work with things like watch, ask, turn, cease fighting, position of neutrality. How can I serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. Sixth sense. Great stuff. You get to practice with it. See, there's no end to the practices. I spent a year working with the idea of what do they mean by a position of neutrality? Powerful, powerful stuff to work with because there's no end to it. How do you not be an AA and be on fire? There's no end to it. If you're not, it's not AA's fault. There's a gold mine in that big book and in those steps, a life you can't even conceive of that is incredibly exciting, fulfilling, peaceful. Fears fall away. God, your light can just take off in ways you can't even imagine. It's available for every one of you. But no one can do the work for you. We're not in the rescue business, Nate. We're not in the fix-it business. There's got to be a part of you within that says, you know what? Thank you, God, for letting me run my life on my will all these years, drunk or sober. But you know what? I think I've had all the fun I can stand. Let me go over here and try another way. Right? You've got to do that. No one can do that for you. No one can do your work for you. You get to decide. There's no limit on how much joy, but you get to decide what you're going to do with that. 12-step takes care of itself, working with other people. So, that's all I got. God bless you. I love you.